Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Today's guest is Tim Urban, and he is the creator of Wait But Why. If you have heard of Wait But Why, you're probably pretty excited right now, as I am, because it is such a phenomenal blog slash website. He writes these amazing long-form, in-depth posts about topics that, as geeks, we kind of care about. So he had a really great post recently about Neuralink, which is Elon Musk's new computer brain interface. And he takes these really complex topics and breaks them down into really simple terms that we can all understand. And that would explain why literally millions of people read his posts, including Elon Musk. So Elon Musk, I think we talked about a little bit in the show, but was actually a fan and a reader of his site and reached out to Tim, and they became friends. And then Elon invited him to go to SpaceX, which we talk about. Yeah, it's actually pretty awesome that Elon also reads this site. But he has a great post also about like the upcoming AI revolution and why procrastinators procrastinate. That one was so awesome that it was turned into a TED talk where Tim went on stage at TED and kind of presented his findings there. Not TEDx, but actually TED proper, which is pretty awesome. And in today's show, Tim and I get in and start talking about how to think more like Elon, also virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and cryonics. You've probably heard me mention and talk about this stuff on various podcasts in the past, but I assure you this is a lot different because it is with Tim, who is an insanely deep thinker. I consider him a philosopher on a lot of these topics. So definitely want to stick around for this one. It's going to be great. Now, a slight change for us here on the show, we're going to start accepting sponsors. This is new for us. And the reason I want to do it, I don't know why I keep saying us, it's just me. So this is new for me. And the reason I want to do this is I want to change it from me to us. And I'd like to hire a researcher and someone to help book talent and just really juggle everything that's going on so we can have a higher quality show for you guys. So I'm going to only accept sponsors, as I always have, in things that I truly believe in. So if I'm mentioning a sponsor here, I've used their product, it's something I can get behind and stand behind, you won't see any kind of backfill sponsors. So there won't be any generic like stamps.com, get your stamping machine, like none of that crap. It'll be really stuff that I can, with a straight face, recommend to you because I enjoy it. So there'll be probably some episodes where we don't have a sponsor because I can't find anything that I really enjoy that I want to recommend. But in this case, for this episode, I'm excited to talk about the Oura Ring. So the Oura Ring is something that you wear on your hand. I've had this thing for probably the last 6 months or so. And the reason I got into it is my doctor, Peter Attia, who you may know from the Tim Ferriss show. He's kind of like a crazy longevity body hacking doctor. He recommended it to me and said, hey, you got to get this ring. It'll help track your heart rate variability. And so that is when you launch the app, it tells you if you're undertrained or overtrained and how hard you should hit the gym that day. It also is very accurate in tracking your sleep cycles. So for me, I had an issue with my deep sleep. It was actually really frustrating when I first got started because my deep sleep was like pegged to the far left. So like the lowest it could possibly be on this bar graph. And so we had to look into, you know, I tried probably 10 different things to try and improve my deep sleep. Changing the temperature of the room, making it a little bit colder, which helps with deep sleep. I was microdosing melatonin to try and help with my deep sleep. I found that the best thing for me anyway was cutting out caffeine, especially coffee, cutting my intake back quite a bit, and then occasionally microdosing melatonin also helped some as well. Anyway, long story short, this ring, because it is such tight and close proximity to the arteries in your finger, it gets really high fidelity data. And that allows them to have better data than anyone else. I guess the reason why I'm having them on as a sponsor is the old ring, in all honesty, it was for the body hackers. If you take a look at it, it looks like costume jewelry. It's kind of like big and clunky. The new ring, if you haven't seen it, I posted it in my last newsletter. It is thin and, I mean, it looks like a standard ring. It's kind of crazy. And this thing, they've now added the ability to do respiration rate, breathing variance, obviously all the old sleep data. The battery on the old ring was just mediocre. It was like a day and a half-ish. This new one has battery up to 1 week with a single charge. And then it also does wireless charging, which happens in 20 to 80 minutes. So this is like the Grail ring, I think is what I refer to it as in my post on my newsletter. But it also does body temperature variation, so it can detect things like fevers or menstrual cycles. It's just like the absolute body hacker's ring. It's like, you know, the Apple Watch or Fitbit on crack. It's really awesome. So anyway, I've been a longtime user of this. They're announcing pre-orders now. If you get in there, we'll get you on the list for a pre-order, and you can use the code Kevin Rose at checkout. No spaces, just Kevin Rose, and you'll get $100 off. I'm really excited to get this thing in my hands, hopefully in the next few weeks. And then I'm also going to, this is the first time I'm actually talking about this, I'm going to incorporate this into my meditation app, Oak. So quick plug for that. You can check out my free meditation app at oakmeditation.com. And I want my meditation app to be really the kind of like body hackers go-to app for meditation. And I'm going to show you pre and post respiration rate, and also your breathing variance and heart rate variability, and just heart rate, showing a little graph after you get done with the meditation. So I want to tie that directly into the Oura API. So if you have one of these rings, in theory, you'll be able to start the meditation and see all that. It should be fun data to look at, and hopefully we'll be able to get some insights out of it when we look at it at a more global level. So that is it. Check out AuraRing.com, coupon code Kevin Rose. All right, so let's get into it. This is Tim Urban from Wait But Why. Last time I saw you actually was when I was doing my going away party in New York. And one of the things that I really enjoyed is you came out for that, and we just started like chatting about like, I don't know, man, like probably like 5 or 10 different topics. And I love how you seem to have this interest for going deep on topics. Is that true? And where did that come from?
So like, I'm very curious. You know, when I get really curious about something, I'll just like go on a spiral and learn as much as I can. If you're a person like that, you end up knowing a little bit about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So that's like my starting point is many things that come up in conversation, I've already thought about at some point or read about at some point. I'm not an expert on anything, but I've already like, you know, I already may have some thoughts. And then the reason I like to go deep is because that's where the interesting stuff is to me. You know, if, for example, like talking recently to paleontologists and we're talking about dinosaurs, and like what's interesting to me, like the really interesting stuff to me about dinosaurs is when you take a big zoom out, which is like where I think it's like every topic is like looking at a beach, like a stretch of beach. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, I don't know what this is. I don't know what that water is. Is that a lake? Is this the ocean? Is this beach like a part of like a whole coastline, or is this just a little cove? So I like getting in like a helicopter and going up, and I'm like, oh, okay, wait, I can see. Okay, wait. This is like a lake, and this is part of this. And then I zoom up further, and I like going in the airplane. And you're like, oh, okay. This is the east part of the continent, and this is a one of the biggest lakes, you know, whatever it is. So to me, that's where things get fascinating. So with like the paleontologist, rather than talking about like what this dinosaur ate and like how big this one was, what's interesting is a big zoom out to realize that dinosaurs as a concept is a clade. It's like a branch of the, you know, the tree of life, and that birds are in the clade as much as T-Rexes are in the clade. Like birds are dinosaurs and they're still here. And that when I think about a bird on the pigeon on the street, they were the royal family before we were the royal family. Right. Like they, you know, and those are like the descendants of like the dynasty before. And it's just, to me, like that kind of thought is like so much more interesting and like than like the, you know, looking at something without the full context. So I think that's my nature to kind of try to do that.
And I mean, I find that when you have that frame of mind, it must give you just a greater appreciation for life around you. I mean, now when you look at a pigeon, you're not going to think like street rat, you know, it's going to like allow you to appreciate this like little creature, you know?
Yeah. I mean, everything is extremely interesting if you look at it the right way. There's literally nothing that I can observe with my eyes or think about that's not interesting if you're thinking about it. Even just like, but you can forget, you know, even just like walking around New York, I will, like anyone else, forget that things are interesting and just be on my way. And if I just pause for a second and like look up at the different architecture, and then I realize, I'm like, wait, that building is super modern. That was clearly built in the last like 8 years. This building probably was from the 1800s. It's a museum of a building from the 1800s right there. And I'm looking at it. It's a live building. It's not a picture of what, right. Well, what did the buildings look like before they harnessed electricity? Well, it's here. You know, I took a tour of downtown Manhattan, like the financial district. I had no interest in financial district. And suddenly I'm realizing this is the most interesting place in the entire city. This stupid black fence where where pigeons were landing on, this metal fence, that was apparently George Washington's request that fence was built there. Yeah, like
that's amazing.
He came and so that's George Washington's fence. He built that. This is literally a museum artifact. I'm holding on to a fence that's been there since the 1700s, and this is the style.
And no one knows that.
Fences in.
Like
no one knows that.
Right.
Exactly. Literally, that's the thing. A fence in New York is fascinating if you just know enough, or you just stop and think about it for a second. You can start to just.
You know, it's funny. I do this too, actually. One of the things that I really enjoy, and I've seen a few times, is like you'll go to those sites where they have the like modern day picture of the same street corner and then the same picture from like, 100 years ago. And you can kind of like drag the little slider left and right and kind of reveal. I'm sure you've seen these things, right?
Yeah.
And it's fun when it's in your own city because we have that a lot in San Francisco. And I'm like, oh my God, like that stuff is still the same and it's still there. And then once you've spent enough time in a city, like I've, been in San Francisco close to 20 years, I start noticing the small little refinements and changes that happen over time, but the structure and the kind of meat on the bones is still there. And it's fun to like age actually, because you get to see this whole evolution of your city over time. It's really cool.
Totally. I agree. I love those sites. And this is actually my comment about how that building, is from the 1800s. That came from those sites. When I realized, I'm like, holy shit, like 100 years ago, this New York looked kind of the same, like shockingly the same in many ways, many streets.
Yeah.
Because
horses and like dirt and shit.
Exactly. Like these are the same buildings that horses were going by. These are the same buildings when the first telephone calls were made. Like, and you just don't consider that. And so, right. I totally agree about that. And I also agree about living in the city for a while because, it's also that you see it change and you see it as like an organism that is a very slow moving, slow growing organism. But also, just kind of as a separate topic, what I like about having lived in New York for like 8 years now is I start to realize that it's basically like almost every corner of the city. I'm not every corner, but many of the corners, many of the areas, I have like distinct memories in. I'm like, oh yeah, well this is where, oh this is that restaurant used to be, and it's just kind of fun. You just start to like, it starts to just kind of be where your life has taken place, and it's like kind of cool. I like that too.
Yeah, I'm really curious. The thing that I'm excited about, I think that's going to happen long term. It's not here today, but I would imagine that, given that we're taking all these photos, right, and they're all geo-tagged, and then eventually the machine learning or AI or whatever it is going to be able to match these up against actual physical structures, I would imagine we'll get to see a kind of a timeline where you'll be able to drag a slider and watch as a collaboration of photos come together to see something change over time. Do you see what I'm saying?
Ooh, yeah. I love that.
I mean, certainly Google Maps will be able to do it. That's a no-brainer. But like, I think that there'll be some type of system that allows user kind of generated photos to join together to kind of create, this timeline of history and of the kind of city evolution.
Well, yeah, you'll go to Street View, and then you can also put a date in the Street View, and then that'll be the difference. Is you can put a date. And you can also press play and you can, it'll go 1 day a second, or you can have it go 1 year a second. So you can change the move. It's like a movie, but you can basically watch a time lapse of any part of any city. And at some point it'll be, you'll go into VR, and I know you don't like VR, but you'll go into VR. It's just, as I said that, I was like,
I love that you remember that. That was a conversation we had that night, like a couple years ago.
Yeah, it's something just popped into my head, a connection between you and VR when I said that. But I think you'll be like in VR looking around, and you can just like click a year and a date, and I can be like 1960, what will feel like 1967 to us in the future. And you're just like 1967, December here. You look around and you're like, okay, look at that. And so
that would be cool.
It's going to be the data that's being collected is going to end up like having so many cool applications. The more time that goes on, I mean, it's right now the data is still pretty young that we have this data. In 20 years, we're going to have triple the data. It's or way more than that, because they'll probably be collecting it at a higher rate. So it's very cool.
Yeah, and it's all siloed right now. So once that kind of gets freed up, that'll be really interesting. Let's talk about VR. I think that'd be a fun one. It's on my list of things to chat with you about because I think it's dumb. I think, I don't think it's dumb. I think that there's very specific applications for VR. Like you, the one you just mentioned sounds phenomenal. Like that, that would be awesome. But you know, there was a lot of hype in the industry around this whole thing being like, you know, the next television or whatever it may be. What's your take, you know, currently? Has your kind of thoughts on this changed over time?
Well, I think in our conversation, we actually seemed to disagree. And then we, when we talked about it more, I don't think we actually necessarily disagreed on at least the fact that what was currently happening, which this is maybe a couple of years ago, it was different. And there was hype, tons of hype. And it's not really there right now. And right. So at the time, we actually agreed that the hype that was currently out there was not like, this is it. The internet's here. You know, this is it. And it's going to be only a year or two before everyone you know is in a VR headset all the time. Right. That wasn't going to be the case. And I didn't quite realize that at the beginning, but by the time I think I talked to you about it, I'd also come to that conclusion. You know, and this follows, I think, a somewhat reliable trajectory. I saw a cool graph online the other day, and it's like the trajectory of new technology in terms of the amount people are talking about it. And what happens is it kind of reaches, it comes of age to an extent, and then you have this, you know, spike. It goes just way up in hype, and everyone's suddenly talking about it. The new, it's, you know, look at cryptocurrency right now, for example. And it's just suddenly it's the buzzword, and everyone's talking about it. Everyone is insecure about, oh, I don't know enough about it. And so have you tried it? You know, it's the thing. Then inevitably, the new, very 1.0, very crappy technology cannot live up to that. And the applications aren't there, and the hardware is not cheap enough, and the software is not very good yet. And it then there's a huge kind of disappointment and a trough of some kind. Then for the ones that do come back, some of them disappear forever. The ones that do come back, then they slowly but surely start to actually come back in a very stable way and sure. And become. So I think that we were at maybe the peak when we talked of that spike. I think we're down now towards this trough. But I firmly believe, after having, you know, spent, because I've prepared for a post on this, which is going to happen at some point when the time clears up. And so after having done lots of interviews, but also trying lots of different kinds of VR programs, trying some cool AR programs. And I don't want to even just say VR, because VR is the 100% point along a spectrum that goes from 0 to 100. Mm-hmm. So 0% is when you're just living with nothing on your head.
Right.
100% you're fully in VR. Every single thing you see and hear is not really there. And then there's AR, which takes you from 1 to 99. And, you know, 20% AR, maybe you're walking around and you see your normal city, but the buildings have a label on it and they have the date they were built, and you can tap a few things and see what restaurants are around, and it just pops up in front of your vision.
Right.
All the way to kind of a 90% when you're, you know, the people walking by all look like pandas, but they're still the people that are actually walking by you.
Right.
And everything looks like a cartoon, but it's actually the same, you know, whatever. So, you know, I'm just inventing things, but like there's a whole range. And so I don't know which part of this range will end up being the killer thing that is, or which parts of it will end up being the stuff that just is ubiquitous. But the concept of this 1 to 100% virtual reality kind of blending in with your normal reality, that concept, I firmly believe, is going to be a major part of basically everyone's life. Maybe 10 years from now. I don't know how long, maybe 5 years, maybe it's 12, 15. I don't know when, but I think you can't judge anything by putting on a big clunky VR headset today with the software, the 1.0 software that's out today. I still think that a lot of them are super fun and impressive given that it's 1.0. I think you can't judge those things based on and say this is not, you know, people are, who's going to want to really do this that much without getting sick of it.
Yeah. I think there's a couple things in my mind that it either has to make the leap of the cell phone. Like the cell phone's a great example of like, we had smartphones, right? They all came out. They were like Windows smartphones or Blackberries, and the hardcore, you know, which in the VR world would be like gamers, right? They all the business people had them, but they weren't really mass adoption kind of like consumer devices at that point. And then, right. You know, it was probably over 10 years later until, you know, because we had a lot of Palm Pilots between now and then. And then finally the iPhone came out, and then boom, it just, everything exploded. So that either happens, or it's the Segway, and the Segway is really cool, and like it's geeky, and it's so big and clunky and awkward, and you look like a dork when you're doing it, that nobody does it. And then there's the hoverboard that comes out, and still it's a little dorky. So it's like, I don't know if this is going the way of the Segway or the way of the cell phone. I'm still kind of trying to hash that out in my
totally head. Totally a good distinction to think about. And a lot of, you know, I'm sure when the Segway was getting going, a lot of people were unbelievably sure that this is how everyone was going to be commuting, and they were wrong. That said, the Segway is one application. And it's like, if you looked at one piece of VR software, one type of gaming, one type of workspace that they currently have, any one of those could, and probably many of them will be the Segway, and that they just will be something no one wants to actually use in the long run. But VR itself is just a medium. It's just a medium. And to me, I've been compelled enough. You know, there's been so many different kinds of software, totally different kinds of experiences. Like, you know, gaming is one. First of all, even within gaming, there's like, you know, so many different like types of games. You can be in like an escape the room, or you can be shooting, you know, shooting game, or you can be, you know, building something, or, you know, art or whatever. There's so many different kinds of games. But even just aside from games, just Google Earth, playing with Google Earth. Yeah. I almost wanted to cry. It was so beautiful. And then going out into space and throwing, you know, and going to, you know, actually flying around to the actual real moon, real Earth, the same size, same distances away. And then I could create a second moon and fling it and watch what it would do. And then when the collision happens with one of them, it's intense, and you can watch orbits. And I mean, the learning, the curiosity, and the beauty, and the scariness, and the, you know, it's like all this heightened stuff. And I'm like, I have a hard time imagining that medium, even though it'll evolve into a medium that maybe isn't in, you know, doesn't look that much like the VR headset today. So it'll evolve, but the eventual evolution of that medium and all the ingenuity that's going to be, and money that's going to be poured into the software if and when it starts to take off as a hardware medium. I have a hard time thinking the human race isn't going to figure out how to make that awesome, really awesome. Now, the hardware needs to get better. It's heavy. Your face is sweaty. It's a little nauseous.
There's wires everywhere. Yeah, exactly.
Right now you have tethered VR, tethered to a PC, an expensive PC. So it's expensive. It's a hard setup. You have to bolt base stations to your wall. But to me, that's like carrying around the briefcase cell phone.
Oh, it's absolutely.
We're going to look back and I'm going to tell my kids, I used to actually put base stations on the wall, and I had a big cord coming out. It's going to seem hilariously old school. So it'd be retro as fuck to have one of these old headsets. But so, and then there's mobile VR, which is, you know, you put your slide, your cell phone into a Gear or into a Google Cardboard or whatever. And those are the two options right now. And they are both lacking. The mobile one, you can move your head, you know, you can swivel, but you can't walk. If you walk forward, nothing happens. So it's kind of, you have the 3 degrees, but you don't have those three other kinds of degrees of movement. And it's just really limited. You don't have any hand controller, so your body's not involved. It's basically, you can watch something cool, a documentary, and so that's limited. And then the PC, for all the reasons I just said, is very limited. The software, you know, there's a lot of fancy software that's coming out that's going to really help with like being nauseous when you're flying around and stuff, but it's not there yet, as I can tell you. The thing that is going to be the killer hardware in the future is this middle ground, this standalone headset, which is a headset with a computer in it that is not hooked to anything. And instead of base stations on the wall seeing where your headset is, your headset's going to have cameras that kind of be, instead of outside in, it's going to have an inside out system. Your headset's going to have cameras that can see the walls. So you can walk around, outside, and it will just render whatever it sees, like a driverless car does.
Right.
It'll just see all the objects and all this, and it'll render those. It'll show you, you know, you'll when you're getting close to something, you'll always know. So to me, that is very, very prototypical right now. It's, you know, Facebook's working on it and Google's working on it, I think. I know Facebook is. And so that's going to get better, and the computers are going to get smaller, more powerful, and the batteries are going to get better, and the heat dispersion technology is going to get better, and things like eye tracking, where right now, you know, if your actual eyes, if you look at something, it's in perfect focus, but right, even just a little bit outside of your, where your eyes are actually focused on, becomes fuzzy. And then the farther you go outside of your focal point, gets fuzzier and fuzzier until your peripheral vision, where it's incredibly fuzzy. That's an energy saving. It's not a good use of energy to make all of the vision, even the stuff you're not looking at, perfectly clear. Well, in VR, right now, every single part of the vision has to be clear because it doesn't know where you're looking. So they're working on things like eye tracking technology that will actually know where you're looking and can save like 70% of the energy.
Oh, wow.
So things like that are being worked on that are
I didn't
make
know that. That's really interesting. That's a good point, too, because the reason the brain doesn't render all of that, well, we don't have the eyes to do it, but even if we did, it would take so much energy to render all of that
right.
all the time.
It's a waste. Yeah, it's not efficient. So that's one, you know, that's one of like 10 cool hardware things that's being worked on where when it gets there, you're going to end up with these little, you know, I think these little nimble visors that have little earbuds on the tips and you just kind of put them on and you're just in another world and it'll feel comfortable. And then of course there's all the social stuff and you'll be able to really have social workspaces. Again, Facebook is working on a lot of that's really hard. So I think VR is currently laying low. And I don't know what form it's going to come back in exactly when and whether maybe it ends up being AR, you know, that ends up being the kind of stuff that everyone's using. I don't know, but I would be shocked if I went in a time machine to 2030 and this wasn't like a giant part of everyone's life. That said, I could see a future where you go forward and no one's using it. And I was like, huh, Kevin was right. Like, it's a segue.
For me, the jury's still out. Like I believe that the form factor is not correct today. Obviously, we all know that, right? And when I saw all this hype coming into it, I'm always, I worry about these cycles of hype. Like I saw the same thing with bots. You know, everyone was all talking about how bots are going to take over here, you know, a year and a half ago. And so, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical about this stuff, especially when it's so geeky. Like when I was one of the first people, so at Google, when I was there at Google X, they were developing Google Glass and they were doing this very limited beta program where they would give out like, you know, they had a dozen or so extra Google Glass to hand out to Googlers. And I knew one of the guys there and he's like, hey, do you want to be one of the first testers? And I was like, okay. So I was, you know, this was a pretty hyped up thing at the time. So I took my Google Glass home and I wore it out and just like the looks from people and the awkwardness of it. And I was like, I had to take it off. And plus the functionality just really wasn't there. It was like, you know, a really crappy, like little mini computer. So I gave it back to them and they were all shocked because they had drank, you know, they pretty much drank the entire pitcher of Kool-Aid at that point. And they just like, why are you giving this back? Like, this is like supposed to be one of the hottest tech, you know, items out there. I mean, that's not what they said, but that's probably what they were thinking. And I was just like, listen, like it's awkward. It's just awkward when you're the first one kind of pushing this new frontier and you look like a dork and you don't want to look like a dork. And that's the same dork like Segway issue that Segway had. And, you know, so anyway, there's a lot of little hurdles, but I agree that eventually this is going to be, I have had fun, a lot of fun in VR. And I can certainly see where if it's lighter, cheaper, wireless, like when all those things come true, it's going to be a fun device for the home. We'll see if it makes the leap to outside of the home.
Yeah.
We can move on from this, but I just wanted to get your current take on that because I know it was something we were debating a while ago.
Yeah, we should every 3 years come back and have a VR chat. To see where things are going. Yeah,
but I want to get your take on Bitcoin these days because cryptocurrency is just like insane right now.
So I haven't written the post on this yet. So I would say like, so I'm very much like a layman's knowledge, but I don't know. I'm not that. I just like, you know, a lot of these new topics that I always know. I actually, writing a blog is a funny way to actually have a good sense of where the hype is. You know, when I got lots of emails about AI a few years ago and I wrote about it. And I got lots of emails about VR and now I'm getting a lot of emails about writing about cryptocurrency, you know, explaining it and you know, people really want to understand it. And I may do it, but I'm just not that excited to learn about it like I am about other things. Like I read enough to understand like the core idea, which is an entirely different kind of paradigm of organization, you know, decentralized thing. And I see how that might have, it's in a very broad sense, it might have like some very important applications later. There might be certain things that can only exist now because we have this decentralized way to do it. And so that is a very broad concept, is interesting, but on its own, it seems a little early to dig in because it's just so, it seems so far away from the time when it's actually a big part of life. So right now, what's happening is it's just more about the actual interesting thing now is the investment opportunity. Mm-hmm. And yeah, okay, sure, that can be like tantalizing. But to me, I'm like, it just seems like it's like, you know, it's like a, it's not quite like, you know, credit default swap concept, but to me it's just like, okay, so we can like jump in on the bubble, you know, who's going to, you know, is jumping on this bubble and which ones are going to be, you know, great investments and which ones are, and I'm kind of like, that's not that compelling, like, to me. It's just kind of like, okay, so who's like, is this like the right time and the right bubble? I think what's more interesting is when all this dust settles, when this hype inevitably goes down, when some of these systems, if and when they do, start to kind of mature into actual platforms that people are building things on, and, you know, the currency becomes, you know, actually important in those areas, then I feel like it'll be, you know, then it can be very interesting. It's right now, I don't know. I mean, I feel like if I'm writing about it now, I'm explaining something that is so new and badly understood that, like, it's not even really, like, real yet. And yeah. And again, mostly I end up, like, I think the people who want me to write about it, it's just because they hear about it, they want to understand it, or they really want to figure out if they should invest. And I'm kind of like, that's not that interesting to me. I mean, I don't know. So it's like, you know, with the VR, I'm like, I can, if this could be like the new internet. Okay, I get that. And then I'm like, and it could be here, and like, it could come soon. You know, AI, I'm like, this is, we're building something smarter than us. Like, this is officially a huge deal, and it's already all around us. And it's already, you know, a massive part of the world. And then general intelligence was so mind blowing as a concept. So I was like, duh. But I'm like, I don't know, decentralized system, really awesome. But like, if that's all I'm writing about, why don't I write about that later once it's something that we're actually maybe starting to maybe possibly be able to use? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that if you dug into this and went pretty deep, you might get a little bit more excited about it. And the reason I say that is because what we see in the press and what we hear from our friends is obviously all about speculation, right? It's like, let me put some dollars in and I'll flip this and cash it out to USD at some point and I'll make some money. But if you take a look kind of under the hood at what's going on, there's two pieces of it that I think are interesting. One is this idea of a fully kind of decentralized internet that is not controlled by any one mass individual. So not controlled by, you know, a Google or an AWS or anyone else. And we actually have control over our own information. And all of that information is encrypted and stored on a blockchain-like service. Because there's a lot of things like Filecoin and all these different types of decentralized apps that are starting to appear. So this could be a new type of internet that we're in the, you know, we'd be in the, like, the 1992 version of that internet. Like, it's still kind of like really slow and sluggish. It's dial-up modem kind of like feeling. But it's, I'm starting to see some of that appear, which is really interesting. And the other piece is that with the spread of smartphones, even to third world countries, there are a lot of countries out there that have completely unstable currencies. And, you know, they're being manipulated by the government. And for people to have something to fall back on that they can use on their smartphone as a way to exchange value, I think that we could see a decoupling of, you know, government and currency, and that be like, you know, the new euro, where all of a sudden we start to see a tipping point and multiple kind of third world countries accept something like a Bitcoin as their default currency. So that's also interesting to me.
When I first heard about this, I just thought of it as a purely as a kind of currency that is not tied to any government. That's where I think a lot of people originally kind of understood what this was. And they didn't understand really what blockchain was. They just understood the concept of like Bitcoin and that it's on some kind of system like Ledger or whatever. That to me, I was like, yeah, duh. Like obviously the government, first of all, countries themselves, I'm thinking a lot about like nation states, like that's a new idea, and it might like not last forever. It's like it's a very like we're in a phase. We're in like the borders phase. We all draw these borders, and we have these nations, and everyone is governments. I don't know. I feel like that's a phase humanity's in, and I'm not sure, you know, if it's a permanent phase at all. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm like, you know, the fact that like money, which is a permanent concept, probably, you know, because that money is just, you know, a way to represent, you know, value without it. And the fact that money is like, you know, right now inextricably tied to governments, which are like actors, it to me is like that is a hack that is not like the final frontier here. And to me, it makes much more sense to have this kind of like objective, like universal value system that it just makes a lot. And that I was like, yeah, okay, that I can see being the far future here. Then I got deeper into it and I'm understanding that like, really, like a lot of what's being talked about here is, you know, this concept of decentralized organization. And I think that itself is also really interesting for stuff like, you know, I mean, just, you know, I've read a few articles that have some very, you know, interesting long-term concepts. I don't know the details, but stuff about how, like, even if government somehow went down, you know, in a really like apocalyptic situation, mm-hmm. you might actually, you know, it might be something like a blockchain type concept that actually ends up being the only thing you can trust, the only thing that's real anymore. And that might end up being the way that people end up governing. I mean, who knows? Or, you know, AI system that can be built where it can be built by the masses, where everyone has some incentive to kind of give it data through, but it's owned by no one. And it's kind of like controlled by no one. And again, I don't know enough to really speak intelligently about any of this, but I'm like, I've heard some things. I'm like, well, that's compelling. But to me, those things just seem just pretty far away. Now, I might be being that guy in 1992. Who I'm like, this internet thing, right. I don't know. You know, or I might be in 1980 saying that. And if I'm in 1980, then I think I'm correct in being like, I don't think 1980 is the right time to write about the internet, because whatever I would have written in 1980 about it, we just wouldn't have quite understood it well enough. I think writing about the internet in 1990 is when I can jump in there and get a right. good enough understanding that I can be 5 years ahead of what everyone else knows with enough interviews and enough reading, and then I can come out and be like, okay, here's this thing. You know, so maybe I'm wrong.
I think you're like 87, 88 right now. That's okay, my take.
That's compelling then. Then, you know, I do plan to. So right now I'm just mired in another thing, but I need to. But once I lift my head out of that, I do plan to dig much more deeply in and at least, you know, read 30 articles about it and have 5 discussions just to, you know, round out my understanding. So I actually really get it, because.
Oh yeah, dude, it's one of those things where I spend a ton of time evaluating these companies, because like as part of my investment job, it's to go out and also look at cryptocurrency deals. And it is a deep, slippery slope. Like I'm in like really deep subreddits, like and just trying to wrap my head around all this stuff. So yeah, I can see how if you're a busy guy, like it's going to take you a long time to kind of go that deep.
Yeah, it's a binary situation. I'm not going to if I get into it, I'm going to get obsessed and I'm going to like do what you're doing, and I'm going to spend 3 or 4 weeks like, and then I'm going to like get it fully. So I need to just decide whether there's so many things to write about right now. There's so many, you know, amazingly compelling things right now going on it's just a decision.
Yeah. Well, I want to pick your brain on AI, because you had a really interesting post on that came out on your site. And just kind of like talk more about just what is going to the thing I see nowadays is people debating whether or not it's going to kill us. And I just want to get your take on what's going to happen when, I mean, I think we all agree now that it's going to happen. When it does happen, what do you think it's going to look like?
Well, first when we say when it happens,
right?
We need to clarify a few things. So to me, I think there's like two stories simultaneously going on, and it's the same big story, but there's two parts. And the first story is what's going to happen between now and 2025. And so just to clarify our terms here, the important terms are narrow intelligence versus general intelligence. You know, humans have general intelligence, can be smart at basically anything. If we just learn it, we can learn, we have creativity, we have, you know, social skills, we have, you know, ability to learn from experience and whatever. That's kind of just being general intelligent. Mm-hmm. And then there's narrow intelligence, which is what any and every software in the world is currently, which is that it's good at one thing or two things. It's good at its job. It's very smart at chess, but it's not good at fuel injection in your car, because that's not its job. And it doesn't have social skills. That's not its job. So
and we have tons of narrow intelligence today. Like that's done, right?
Right. So narrow intelligence is everywhere, and it's running like people will think about things like when you buy a flight, the price, who knows how those prices are set? Seems like there's no rhyme or reason. An AI set that price. When you land in your plane, the gate is set by an AI. An AI chooses that gate. So you don't realize, your car is, all these internal systems, anti-lock brakes, fuel injection, it's all run by AI. So things that are, obviously self-driving cars is obvious AI. Siri is an obvious AI, but there's all kinds of non-obvious like moments when you're using AI. And actually the guy who coined the term AI gets frustrated. He says that once it works, no one calls it AI anymore. So narrow intelligence alone. So by 2025, I've heard a lot of different predictions about when artificial general intelligence may be here in this planet. And almost none of them have ever said 2025, something that early. So I think I can safely say 2025 will still probably be a world without general intelligence. But the narrow intelligence, I believe, is going to infiltrate in a whole different level that we're used to. That can be only compared to what I think happened in like the 1880s when electricity went from kind of like used in certain applications, used in industries, to it was everywhere and part of everything. It was in every home. It was every single industry. I mean, if you think about it right now, there's almost nothing that's happening in your wherever you live that's not using electricity. If the power goes out, it affects basically everything and everyone except for the Quakers. So we may be moving towards a world like even, you know, within the next decade where basically only Quakers wouldn't have AI in infiltrated to most of their life. Mm-hmm. That's a different level than we're at now. So there's a lot of examples like things like, you know, mammograms or other kinds of fMRI or CAT scan assessments are still done mostly by people. But people are not very good at this. Like mammograms, which is a really tragic thing to get wrong, you know, like a breast cancer scan, and getting it wrong either way is tragic. And yet 20% of the time, doctors get it wrong because they're really hard to analyze. You know, it's not obvious. Mm-hmm. So 80% success rate. So they just at Houston Methodist Hospital did a trial where they basically had humans go against AI to assess mammograms. Well, humans did their typical 80%, right? And AI got it right 99.6% of the time, 30 times faster. So that's not even close. And it's important. And so therefore, it won't be long before it's medical malpractice to not have AI doing things like mm-hmm. this. The concept of a human doing that is going to seem like the most ancient medical primitive stuff. Okay, you know, they have like paralegals. You know, they have AI doing work of paralegals right now. That it's just better. It's just better at it. And when something's better, like the economy is gonna latch onto that and it's gonna infiltrate. So there's all these different jobs that we consider pretty high level. You know, these are, you know, medicine and law. I mean, and that are really going to be changed by AI.
One question for you though, I feel like, you know, AI in my mind, and I don't know if I'm alone in this, but when I hear artificial intelligence, I think like smarts behind the scenes, right? And what you're describing is like a narrow set of actually just like code, but is it really intelligence? Like, is it really learning? Like, you know, if you throw a wrench in there into any one of your scenarios that you talk about AI, like something really drastic, not just like a standard abnormality, but something crazy, the AI can't go and say, oh, I understand this new wrench that was thrown in here, and now I'm going to adapt. Can it?
Well, I think the core definition of AI is, you know, it's like software that's designed to make intelligent decisions or accurate predictions in some problem domain. Right. So by that core definition, you know, what I described is AI. And there's also
but it's not consciousness in any way then.
No. The very narrow intelligence isn't anywhere near conscious. It's just what you realize is these things we think, oh, that's a human job. Actually, you're doing a narrow intelligent thing with your job and you don't realize it. And most of us in the end, a lot of our jobs, you know, in the world here are narrow intelligence, you know, truck driving is one of the biggest jobs. A narrow intelligent AI can do that. And a lot of like the jobs that, you know, different kinds of medical technicians, law and in finance, JP Morgan has something called COIN, which is like contract intelligence, you know, analyst system or whatever. It's just, this is something that's always been done by people and they replace 200 full-time employees recently that were in charge of like assessing contracts in some way that they need by an AI system that does it. And I assume that the way that those systems were built in the first place, a lot of it's by machine learning where they're taught about certain things with contracts. And then there's some kind of element of they do a bunch and get feedback and start to just hone in and really, you know, get, you know, more and more accurate with assessing, you know, a good or a bad contract or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that's what our narrow intelligence is. It's really good at one thing. But that's enough to utterly like invade a lot of what we're used to humans do.
But when does the general intelligence happen?
So, you know, the shorter term you have, narrow intelligence is going to, you know, it's going to replace a ton of jobs. It's also going to enhance a ton of jobs and it'll also create a bunch of new jobs. There's going to be, you know, all kinds of people in 100 years ago said there's, you know, 90% of the workforce fed America. It was all related to food somehow. And today it's 2%. So if you just told someone that, they'd say, oh, 88% of jobs are disappearing. But of course, that's not what happened, you know. So I think it'll be okay. Then we get to this like big moment when AI is general intelligence. when you have AI that is actually smart across the board. And of course, AI has all this advantage over us when it gets there. So there's no reason to believe it would just stay at human level intelligence. It's going to be super intelligent compared to us. You know, it's unlike a human brain. A human brain can only be so large, because not just because of its skull, but it moves slowly. Information travels slowly through neurons compared to the speed of light. If it's too much bigger, the right one side of the brain wouldn't be able to communicate with the other side in order to make it a single cohesive system. AI can be the size of a computer can be the size of a dwarf planet before it has that same problem. So it can get much bigger. It never gets tired, or it never forgets things. It never ages. It's editable. It's upgradable. And the collective intelligence, which is what makes humans so special. No human on the earth knows how to make a pencil. Right. You know, every part of it. Let alone, you know, build buildings. But collectively, our collective intelligence is this like giant that we've created that is a genius that can build anything. Mm-hmm. That's just from talking, from language, from sharing information. One AI learns something and it instantly syncs with every other AI on the planet. You know, that's why self-driving cars are going to be so good, because you might, you know, drive past a deer and freak out and swerve out of the way because you've seen only one once. If you saw it 8 times, you'd be better at it. Well, every time any car, self-driving car, sees a deer, it syncs with every other car on its platform. So the collective intelligence is just going to skyrocket. So for every reason, we have to believe it's going to be so much smarter than we are. But when it's smart across the board, it's just a different concept, and it's way more intense. I mean, now you have something on this earth that is as smarter than we are, as we are than monkeys, if that makes sense.
But is it even going to care? Like, when I look at an ant, like, obviously, it's orders of magnitudes of intelligence difference between us and an ant. Like, I look at an ant, I don't care about the ant. Like, is it even going to care about humans?
That's the fear. The fears that people have are not that there's evil AI that's anthropomorphizing, which is, you know, applying human characteristics and values to something that's fundamentally...
Doesn't Elon think AI is going to harm us?
Yes, but they don't think so. But people who think so, they don't think it's because the AI is going to be evil. They don't think it's going to be like an evil human. That's anthropomorphizing. They think it's going to kill us, the people who think it is, because it's a natural psychopath. It's distinctly not human, which means it's not going to be evil in the way that it's not going to be, you know, like want, you know, it's not going to have an ego that wants power. What it is going to do is going to be a natural psychopath. Sometimes what we consider the most evil people in history, it's not that they're cruel and they enjoy human suffering. It's that they simply don't have the capacity to care. They don't have compassion of any kind. They don't have that humanness that we can associate with people. And so, you know, serial killers who just feel no remorse. It's just like, you know, it creeps us out. Well, this AI, it's a very nuanced concept to have empathy the way we have it, to value human life in the specific way we have it. We value animal life, but we value certain animals more than others. And we value humans way more than animals, but we also don't care. We don't want a human harming an animal. It's very complex. It seems simple to us because we are humans. And evolution has optimized us in a very specific way to feel a very certain kind of empathy. Mm-hmm. If an AI doesn't feel that the same way and isn't really programmed in a similar way, it's going to kind of be on a different page. And when you have something with, you know, think about how much power we have over monkeys from a little difference in intelligence. Like, you know, a monkey is super intelligent. And yeah, we put it in a cage and there's nothing it can do. We have a gun. We have a taser. We can electroshock it. We can poison its food. We can play God to the monkey only because we have a little bit more cognitive capacity than they do.
But so I would argue that the reason we know the monkey exists is because we have sensors that can detect it, right? Like we have eyes, we have all these different, like AI is not going to have any of that. So it's not going to even be able to see us per se, like in the same way, in the same light, right?
Right. Well, although it'll often be connected to robots and other things that have cameras and, you know, it'll be smarter than us. So if it thinks that vision, you know, being able to sense photons is an important thing for what it needs to do, it'll build that pretty quickly. Just like, you know, if Einstein could build it, it'll have no problem because it's way smarter than Einstein. And this is the thing that can get scary is that, you know, the same power we have over monkeys because of our little thing, it's going to have that same power over us. The power something this smart will have is a power we've never seen on Earth. We don't understand it. And that's when you get worried that this, so who is this powerful being? What is its nature? What does it care about? You know, we don't hate ants. Like you mentioned ants. If you build a house on top of an anthill, it's not because you hate the ants. It's because you're just trying to do something and they're in the way. So it's going to have this power, but it's a natural psychopath unless we program it otherwise. Now, you say, okay, well, let's program it to be good. But what the hell does good mean? Ask 10 of your friends in San Francisco, right, you know, within a very similar world, and they're going to disagree. Yeah, now ask 10 people in 10 different countries, well, 10 different religions.
It's going to be able to reprogram itself in 2 seconds anyway, so what does it even matter?
Well, right, if it wants to. So it's like, you know, exactly. It's going to be able to reprogram itself, but if you programmed it in a way in the first place where, you know, it's like a human, we all have different goals, but underneath those are our core programming, which is self-preservation and reproduction, which is basically two sides of the same coin, which is passing genes along. The amount that you don't want to fall off a cliff, that's the amount that AI will want to do what its core goals are. I mean, core goals are core goals. So it'll only reprogram itself if its core goals kind of make it want to. So that's this question is, you know, how do you program these things? What do you give it as its kind of like most innermost desire, you know, that it wants? When I say wants, you know, I just mean that it is programmed to, you know, to try to achieve. And but the problem is, you know, the reason this is hard to talk about is that you can hear all the experts in the world, but I know when the human species does not know yet what they're talking about, when experts vigorously contradict each other and they change their own minds and they're all over the place. And that's when I say, okay, I can look, you know, if I look at the group of experts as a single organism, I'm like, yeah, each expert seems all confident. This organism has no idea what the fuck they're talking about. And that's how you can assess. And so and because why would it know what it's talking about? This is new.
Well, this is the whole thing. My point is, I mean, do we even need to debate this? Because if you think about it, we're just a bunch of ants trying to figure out what humans are like and what they're going to do, right? Like, we have no clue. And we probably won't even be close, anywhere close to what AI is actually going to be or feel, or the amount of knowledge it's going to have. Like, why even try and figure it out?
Well, because this thing is going to have the power to, on the good side, to solve every problem we have: poverty, climate change, you know, disease, and including mortality. On the other side, it has the power to easily wipe out the species or all life on Earth. So the stakes are so high that it's like, well, let's take a crack. Let's at least try our best, you know. And that's like what someone like Elon Musk is trying to do. He does not feel great about this. He wishes we wouldn't build it. He knows that there's nothing you can do to stop the human species from building something it's economically incentivized to build. So it's going to happen. You can't regulate your way out of this. It, you know, if you do, then other countries get ahead. This is going to be built. It's racing ahead. And so, you know, he calls it summoning the demon, but the demon's coming at this point. So he says, well, let's do whatever we can. He's trying to take his best crack at creating a safe future. And, you know, for him, that's a two-part solution. One is OpenAI, where, you know, if we're creating a magic wand that can, you know, give you power over all the rest of humanity, and itself is going to be an all-powerful magic wand, well, let's not have two companies building that. Let's at least get like as many, you know, as many magic wands being built at once that all can kind of check and balance each other. So let's not have one Superman on the planet. Let's have many. And second side of the coin is Neuralink, his newest company, which is, you know, brain-machine interfaces. Which has a lot of cool applications, but the reason he really wants to do it is so that we can all kind of become AI. So yeah, the other side of the coin in Neuralink, I mean, the goal is that, you know, if you have your limbic system and your prefrontal cortex or your cortex, and they argue with each other, you know, your limbic system says, oh my God, eat that brownie. It might be the only calories we get for the next 2 weeks. You have to eat it because it thinks it's 50,000 BC. Your limbic system always thinks it's 50,000 BC. Mm-hmm. And your cortex, who's in 2017, says, do not eat the brownie. This is ridiculous. Don't eat the brownie, right? And you're not being a crazy person. Those aren't two people arguing. It's just you thinking, right? That's how he thinks this third layer of electrodes in your head, which is going to communicate with an AI. He thinks it's going to be like a third voice in there, but it's you. You're going to have biological and artificial intelligence in your own head. And he thinks if that's the case, then we are AI, and then maybe we're along for the ride when AI takes over the world. So it's far-fetched, but, you know, that's the kind of solutions that we need, is these really out there solutions for sort of a really out there problem.
Yeah. I want to talk about Elon, because Elon obviously is a big fan of your site. It's someone that you've gotten to know personally over time. You've written blog posts about him, but I'd love to jump into what you've learned from him and his kind of psyche, and how other people can be more like Elon. Like, how can they be more, have that entrepreneurial kind of spirit? And what do you think the magic sauce is there?
Yeah. So I spent 6 months in this first project writing about SpaceX and Tesla and all these other industries around.
Have you stand next to one of those big rockets, by the way? Have you been like...
Oh, my God, yeah. I love it. They're huge.
I want to see one of those. They're so cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to visit the SpaceX factory. It's extremely... It's unbelievable. I haven't yet seen the Mars transporter, but that, I don't think many people have. But
Did you go inside of one? Did you walk next to the engines? Like, is it...
I was able to kind of step up on the ladder and look in. I've been in the seat of a... I went into the seat of the Dragon 2, which is going to be that takes humans to the space station and cargo to Mars. It's not going to be the transport that takes 100 people to Mars. But yeah, it's extremely advanced. It's awesome. I mean, it couldn't be, you know, like 7-year-old Tim can't believe he gets to go into a spaceship factory. It's just like so awesome. Cool. Yeah, it's like, I can't believe something this cool exists and that I get to like walk inside of it. So yeah, it's extremely cool. I was the most fun project ever. I mean, Tesla is all electric vehicles and energy and understanding. It's just extremely, extremely cool companies. And getting to work with Elon and the execs was, you know, unbelievable, right? But I had two questions when I wrote this series. The first was, why is he doing what he's doing? What are these companies? Why are they here? Why do they matter? And the second question, which is, was why is he able to do what he's doing? Who the hell can start PayPal, then start SpaceX and Tesla, then start OpenAI on the side while also SolarCity, while also
boring company,
boring, trying to change the way we transport around cities, and then start Neuralink, a brain machine interface company to try to make us AI. It sounds like a crazy person, but he's genuinely making groundbreaking, world changing progress in each of these. I mean, the proof is in the pudding here. So to me, I'm like, this dude has something going on. And it was hard to believe that he's just so smart and driven because, you know, there would be a lot more Elon Musks, right? Mm-hmm. If there was just intelligence and drive, there's something else. And so actually, I started to look at what is the secret sauce. And the very first taste I got of what I think it is, I got from your podcast, Foundation, your interview with him. You asked him a question, you know, what would your advice be? Or sort of some version of that question. He talked about, I think it's important to reason from first principles versus reasoning by analogy. Mm-hmm. This really intrigued me. And I sensed just hearing that this might be what he's doing that is so special. And so I dug in and I really looked for that distinction in the way he talked, in the decisions he made, I watched other interviews with him, including my own discussions. And I tried to kind of assess, how does this guy reason? And is it different? And the answer, I think, is overwhelmingly yes. I think it is different than the way that we reason. And so I looked further into this concept, and the best way I can describe like reasoning from first principles versus reasoning by analogy is, you know, I like to use an example of like in the 1600s, you had two camps for geologists. So you had the camp that said, they look at the Grand Canyon and said, well, we know that the Earth started 6,000 years ago because the Bible tells us that. So that's a fact. Now we also see seashell fossils here. What does that mean? It must be the biblical flood. You know, and they would come up with some kind of logic that connected what they thought was definitely truth to what they observed. And they every theory they had to fit into that structure.
Sure.
Then there was the second camp who said, well, we don't know anything. Let's not believe the Bible. Let's not believe anything anyone says. Let's just observe and take our observations. Those are our first principles. It's a physics term. Those are our first principles. And then those are the things we know. And then we will use those as the puzzle pieces with which to kind of construct a conclusion. And their conclusions very quickly brought them back to the Earth being 5 billion years old. That's the scientific method. It's you take your evidence, you use it as you build a hypothesis, you test it, you eventually get to a conclusion, and it's just a theory. It's never a law. And there's always room for new evidence to come in. And if it does, then it might change your conclusion, et cetera. I think that today, most of us, most people probably listening to this podcast identify with the science geologists. They say, well, I'd be like that. You know, I wouldn't just look at the Bible. Of course, I would observe. And yet I think in like so many parts of our lives and so much of what our decisions and the way we think, we are being flood geologists. We have a Bible in our hand that we believe is our starting point. And that Bible can be conventional wisdom. The Bible can be something our parents have always said to us. It can be what our generation seems to think, our friends, our political party, whatever it is. And, you know, some self-help book, whatever it is. We start with a Bible and we go from there and we don't realize we're doing that. And it actually hindered the flood geologist's ability to get to the truth. I think it hurts our ability to actually make accurate decisions this makes sense back in the tribal days, which is what our bodies are optimized for. You don't have to reason from first principles because conventional wisdom was wise. Every generation was the same as it was 10 generations ago. So conventional wisdom was damn wise. If someone says, don't eat that berry, don't eat the berry.
Don't touch the snake. But, yeah, absolutely.
Right. But today your grandmother has no idea what the fuck you do for a living because the world changes so quickly that conventional wisdom is outdated. By the time it becomes conventional wisdom, it's outdated. It's no longer wise, but our brains are not wired to think that way. We trust it. We trust it over ourselves in all kinds of areas, in the way we choose our lifestyle, our jobs. And what I think makes Elon Musk special, which is also what makes Steve Jobs special, which is also what made the Beatles special, which is also what made Henry Ford special, Marie Curie special, these people that like just completely disrupt and just create a new paradigm. What they're doing is they are being science geologists about everything. So Elon, classic, there's many Elon examples, but one of them is he sells PayPal, ends up with $180 million. You know, young guy, everyone and their mother would say, do not go put that all down on something right now.
Right.
Go into a nice career of angel investing and maybe start something else and that's small, or you do it with other people's money or whatever. He said, I'm going to start a rocket company. I think he did crunched some numbers. And he said, I think that we can cut the cost of space travel down. I think we can learn to land a rocket. People said, okay, NASA, the Soviet Union, none of them could land a rocket. They tried. The cost of space travel is what it is because incredibly smart space agencies for decades have gotten it to this great place that it is.
Who tries to take on NASA? Like, just hearing the term NASA is like, of course they have the best engineers, you know?
NASA 50 years earlier had gone to the moon, or 40 when he started this. And by the way, they said that there's a long list of billionaires who have tried to start a rocket company, and every single one has failed. His friend actually made him a video of a compilation, a montage of rocket explosions, just to get his mind out of this zone. And so every Bible that could exist was very much saying one thing: this is a bad idea, don't do it. You're going to lose your money, whatever. So his first principles, well, one of them was, if I lose my money, I'll be okay. He lived on $1 a day in college and taught himself that like what everyone perceives in their Bible as horrible risk, you know, of losing your money is not actually danger on the other side of that risk. So it's not really risk. You know, that was first. Secondly, he said this is really important. And thirdly, he said, my numbers add up. My numbers suggest I think we can probably do this. There's a good chance we'll fail, but it's worth it for the probability. So just as a pure scientist, basically on a chalkboard, crunch some things and all the factors added up to this is a good idea to start it. So he did. No one makes that leap. That makes him extremely unusual. So, by the way, talk about who challenges NASA. No, there was no successful car startup in the U.S. since Chrysler 90 years earlier, and he started Tesla. So this is someone who is very aware of the truth, which is that conventional wisdom is very often wrong. He's also aware that someone who reasons from first principles, like any bold scientist, is going to fail most of the time, a lot of the time, but they're going to succeed in ways that no one has ever succeeded before. When they do, it's going to be original. And he understands that failure is not a big deal and that it's worth it to whatever. So all that together makes him, it sounds like I'm just saying obvious things. I think our wiring is so contrary to that, because we're not optimized for 2017 life, that I think it makes him like one in a million. And then you combine that, of course, with he's a very talented, very hardworking, very driven guy. But I think you look at Steve Jobs. He didn't say, let's build a phone. So what should our keyboard look like? Let's make it an Apple-y fresh keyboard. Let's make it cooler looking than any other keyboard. No, he said, what should a mobile device be? Let's ignore everything else. I don't care what Nokia is doing. I don't care what's succeeding out there already. And by the time they were done puzzling with their first principles, there was no keyboard. And then, of course, everyone copies them because they come up with something new. So you can just look at example after example of like people who weren't geniuses. You know, Edison failed 700 times. It's just that they understood that, you know, it's like a cancer researcher. You don't want the cancer researcher who's scared to fail, so he only wants to do experiments that have already succeeded and do little iterations. You want someone who's rolling their sleeves up, getting their hands dirty, and just saying, let's try a bunch of stuff. And that's what, you know, the entrepreneurs and the artists. So, to me is it.
When I was doing that foundation series, one of the themes that I saw that was pretty common is that all these entrepreneurs that have been really successful, they consider failure really... Failure is such a like negative term to so many people. But they just consider it learning. You know, like failure is just admitting that you've learned something.
Yeah, I mean, if you're again, you're trying to cure cancer of some kind, and you do an experiment, and you think it's first of all, you think it's good and someone says, actually, it's, your experiment is flawed. Here's why. That's called negative feedback, right? The cancer researcher says, oh, thank you. You just made my right. experiment better, right? In the
and
real world,
we get negative feedback.
Yeah, we call people an asshole in the real world for it, and we don't want to hear it.
Right.
It makes no sense. It's not how you actually. And then and likewise, if a cancer researcher tries something and it fails, he's okay, good. Another puzzle piece in the puzzle, as opposed to saying, oh God, this failed. I'm a terrible scientist. I'm so embarrassed. Everyone's talking about me. I need, why did I ever take that risk? It makes no sense. And if you had that attitude, you'd be a horrible cancer researcher. So I just think it's obvious when you think about a scientist in the lab, and somehow it's not intuitive to us, the same lesson. When we think about, entrepreneurs or again, artists or a lot of people trying a lifestyle innovation, whatever it is, I think that it's not obvious. But yet, if you just take a step back, you realize that it's not any different. And the cancer researcher, by failing, nothing happened. He didn't starve to death. And neither will people. A little bit of embarrassment, maybe. Big deal. I don't know. So
have you ever been with Elon when he's trying to kind of select an idea? I would imagine when you have these, six, seven, whatever companies he has going on now at the same time, there has to be a lot left on the cutting room floor, right? There's probably dozens or hundreds of different ideas that he's looked at or potentially evaluated. Is he just a very creative person in that he's just coming up with these ideas? Do people bring him ideas? How does that work?
Well,
meaning,
I think
new potential spaces to explore, like before he gets into the first principles, like who's coming up with the genesis of these original ideas?
I think this ties back actually to one of the first things we talked about, which is if you look up at the buildings in New York, or you look around, or you just think for a second about reality, a lot of people do psychedelics to get themselves with in this fresh eyes zone. Mm-hmm. But if you just look at everything, try to do it with fresh eyes, suddenly all of this insight comes into your head and all these interesting thoughts and all this kind of wisdom that isn't normally there. And so I think that what Elon is good at is he looks at the whole world that way all the time. So he just sees everything for what it is, as opposed to kind of what that, what he used to think it was, and that just sticks, or what people say it is. So when he looks at something like airplanes, we all just assume that's how airplanes are. There needs to be that little tail that goes up on the side, and the wings are the way they are for some obvious genius reason. That's reasoning by analogy. That's saying things are the way they are for a good reason, and I shouldn't. And if I think that's wrong, it's because I'm missing something. So he doesn't think that way. So he looks at an airplane and says, what should an airplane be? And before you know it, he has this idea, which is the real idea he does have. So to talk about cutting room floor, electric aircraft that are vertical takeoff and landing, that go above high enough, 80,000 feet instead of 35,000, where the air is thin enough that they can go way faster and get across, New York to LA in 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and using no fossil fuels in the process. That's something that you only think about in the first place if you're looking at everything as this is, again, to bring Steve Jobs back again, he had this quote that there's this key lesson in life that everything you see around you that you call life was built by and designed by people no smarter than you. Mm-hmm. People only have a few decades and no one's wise yet in a few decades. And everyone's just taking their best crack as amateurs. And then things stick, though, because of the reasoning by analogy concept. Everyone just then assumes that's the best way. That's how it's done. And no one challenges it. And it actually, if you just look at the world that way and say this airplane is the way it is, probably because someone in the 40s or 50s took a first crack and it just kind of stuck. Gas cars are gas cars because that's what started. And then everyone just started reasoning by analogy, even though electric cars are a much better idea. And so I think when you're looking at things that way, ideas are going to pop out all over the place. Everything you see is, everything can be better. Now how? And so, yes. And he's also has an amazing understanding of physics, better than almost anyone. This is where he's, I think, could be called a very legitimate genius in his understanding of engineering and just how physics and engineering work. Like, he can see it in his head in ways that other people can't. So I think when you combine those two things, along with a deep understanding of how the business world works, how, money flows, how actual, economies work, you combine all those and you can just look at anything and probably immediately think of, this would be better if. Mm-hmm. So he's driving to work and he's thinking about tunnels, and he's flying in a plane. He's thinking about vertical takeoff and landing planes. And so ideas are going to pop out all over the place. What he reserves his projects for the most part, are things he thinks have the chance of having a big impact on what he would call raising the probability that humanity has a good future. I mean, that's what ends up with that what he thinks is, again, he's just being logical. Well, what's the most high impact thing I can dedicate my time towards? The things that have the biggest chance of a long-term impact, because the future is uncertain, and we want to make it good, and we can raise the probability of it being good by, you know, reducing fossil fuel emission with accelerating the advent of a sustainable energy world. These are the wording he uses for this stuff. So I think that his reasoning, the way he comes up with projects, is pretty simple. He looked at the world, and he sees everything that could be better in different ways, and he thinks about and better for him, that scale is defined by, you know, good future probability and versus bad future probability. And so he's always thinking about stuff like AI because he's obsessed with the future of humanity, which is, you know, we're lucky that he's obsessed with that. He could be obsessed with making money, in which case he would very quickly be the richest guy in the world, I think. And he could be obsessed with changing media. I mean, he could test a lot of things. I think it's nice that he's obsessed with these biggest ideas. It's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tim, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, so thank you so much. But I have one last question for you. I really enjoyed, we didn't get into it on this podcast, but on your cryonics and freezing, extending life via freezing yourself like a popsicle. Are you going to freeze yourself?
Yes, and
you are.
To get the wording right, it's not freezing, and it's not like a popsicle, because if you did that, your cells would burst, because frozen water expands, and you would be irrecoverable. It's vitrifying, which is slowing down. It's using antifreeze to bring you to such a cold temperature that but it won't freeze because you put antifreeze in your bloodstream. Instead, it just moves to such a slow state that the atoms that make up your body literally can't move. So you're just on biological pause. And the hope is that not bet on the future here, because 100 years ago, they'd be shocked by what we can do today. And I think we're going to be shocked by what they can do, equally shocked what they can do in like 30 years.
Right.
So,
but we still have to wake someone up from that state, though.
We do. But the point is, they're on pause for this foreseeable future. Let the future take a crack at it. And
right.
So there's two arguments here. One is, what's the alternative here? Going into the ground to rot and disappear, period. The other alternative is, hey, let me throw my brain with my personality and my memories and my goals and my hopes and dreams. Let me throw that to the future and see what they can do with it. Just in case. Why not? It's very cheap, all things considered. It's a cheap life insurance policy plus a few hundred bucks a year. So to me, there's a big why not. Secondly, Eliezer Yudkowsky, who writes the site Less Wrong, I like the way he worded this, where he said, you know, if you want to really, really securely erase a hard drive on a computer, mm-hmm. you have to basically burn it. You have to burn it. There's almost nothing you can do.
Yeah.
You can soak, you can throw it away, you can hit it with a hammer. Yeah, you know, a good enough technician can get the information out of there still, mm-hmm. especially one in the future. Imagine in 20 years, someone's going to be able to get that information if they really want it, right? So what he says is a human dying and it's kind of going brain dead and going into, that's not a secure way to erase a human hard drive, a human brain hard drive. It's not. Meaning, we can get the info out. And if you think about what is a human life in the end, in the end, it's really the arrangement of the atoms in your brain. That arrangement is what your memories come from, your personality, your talent. So it's, if you can preserve that arrangement, the future really might be able to either actually restore that physical brain or copy that arrangement and upload it somewhere where that arrangement wakes up and it's you. Now you have the question of, you know, is that actually you? And is your consciousness have access to that? We don't know. And there's a big, the cryonicists, what I liked about it when I read, I started very skeptical, but what I liked is that they seem like very humble people. They're science-based. They're not kooks. They really know their science. Mm-hmm. And they're the first to say, yeah, we don't know. We have no guarantee. They're not snake oil salesmen. They don't do any selling. They say, we don't know. There's a very good chance this will never work. But there's a good reason to believe that you give your paused brain with all of your stuff in it, and you give it in the same exact format that it was when you were unable to kind of live longer with today's technology, when the current hospitals of today were unable to save you. Let's give that to a hospital 30 years from now and see what they can do. Or let's just give, why not? Kick that brain to the future. Like, it would be fun to be around. I want to see what happens. I want to see how cool the phones are in 2080. So, you know, I see a big why not here. And here's the big thing for me. I'm an atheist. Until this happened, I basically all I'm thinking is, I'm going to disappear forever. And that's a pretty depressing thought for me. Some people like that thought, I don't. And so I was always jealous of religious people, even people who might be a little religious, who might say, you know, I don't know if there's a God. I don't think there is, but, you know, I never know. And they're on their deathbed and they're thinking, who knows? Maybe I will blink right now, dead, and wake up somewhere else. That's a comforting ass thought. And I like the idea that.
That's the only way it can be, though, right? Because there's non-consciousness. And then there's the way you're ever going to come back is if you blink and you're somewhere else. That's the only thing you will ever know. There will be no skip in time. Right, exactly.
Like, but I'll be a happier old person and truly a happier person now, just knowing that there's a possibility of that blink versus the permanent blackout. Even if it's a 5% chance, give it to me. When you're calibrated to a 0% chance, 5% sounds amazing. It sounds super exciting. If you're calibrated to, you know, there's definitely a God and there's definitely heaven, then you're not going to do cryonics. That's going to sound crazy. But I'm not. So if you're an atheist, I see no reason. If you're an atheist who wishes they could live longer, I don't want to live forever. That would be crazy. There's too many years. It's too much time for a consciousness to be around. If you talk about, you know, Graham's number of years, but living an extra 1,000 years, living an extra 5,000, 50 centuries, a century is nothing. I would knock out 50 centuries. I'd have fun. I would master all these different things. I would get into all different kinds of.
Like, I have a feeling that my take is that if we extend life and we make it so that you can just continue to live onward, you would probably develop kind of this extreme paranoia around dying, meaning like they get hit by a bus scenario.
Well,
you wouldn't skydive. You wouldn't do any of these fun things.
That's true, but I kind of think of that a future advanced enough to unvitrify a cryonics patient, or to I think is also a future that is good enough. And by the way, if someone's living thousands of years, it means they're not using a human body, or they have this immense repair system of nanobots in their bloodstream or whatever. But I think it's mostly that they're using artificial organs, artificial body,
right,
maybe even an artificial brain, and they're kind of a consciousness that's probably backed up somewhere.
So like Fifth Element, when they find the arm and then they reconstruct her entire body and wake her up, basically.
Yeah, something like that. I think that we're talking about, you're thinking AI is a different world. Like, this is really different we're talking about. And I just think that I know I could fill up 50 centuries and not get bored, because I could dig into understanding how carpentry works for the next decade and be happy. I would love to learn how buildings are built for the next 20 years. Yeah. Why not? And then I would take 5 years off curiosity, and I would get really into, you know, physical stuff. I would like to work with my hands, or I'd like to meditate or whatever. Yeah, who the hell knows? But I think that it could be fun. And by the way, you can bow out anytime you want. So if I change my mind, I can say, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to go dark now. We'd have a big ceremony. That's how people should go out. You have a big ceremony. You get to say bye. It's this happy celebratory moment. It's melancholy, but it's happy. And you choose. The saddest thing ever is a person with full of life, full of curiosity, you know, an Oliver Sacks. This person is just getting started and they're taken away. Or, of course, someone dying or young, or just someone you love dying. This is right. A horrible tragedy of the past. And we're in the past, unfortunately. And it's going to look like this barbaric time we were alive. So I like the idea of voluntary death. And what I don't like is all of the people, that stigma around it, that it's like this vain, narcissistic quest for eternal life by rich white guys, because that's not fair. If 100 years ago, people lived to 40 on average, and I guarantee there are all kinds of people that said, you know, dying at 40 is the lot of man. You know, why do you want to live to 80? That's this vain. No, now we all live to 80, and everyone's happy about that. No one wishes we died at 40. Most of what dying later is going to mean is curing diseases that make your end of the life horrible and
right.
Kill you before you're ready. So yeah, I'm all for it.
Yeah, in the short term, I'm just hoping that we can really improve lifespan or health span, not just lifespan. You know, so the quality, that's a key part of this.
That's natural. That will happen. It's the same way. You know, I agree that like a bunch of vegetative 110-year-olds is not a good solution. But what makes someone vegetative? Disease. Whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's a stroke that happened, whether it's their body has, you know, deteriorated. That's all just different forms of disease. And it's just a physical object, your body, that is deteriorating. So I think part of living longer is going to inherently mean fixing the deterioration, which means you're going to be 110 and climbing Everest, I think. So that would be the goal for sure.
Yeah, that sounds like an awesome future. Well, Tim, it's been great having you on the show. Thank you so much for doing this. And for people that want to reach you online and socially, what are the best avenues for that?
WaitButWhy.com is where I live online, and all the social media sites with WaitButWhy, and the email list is where we kind of encourage people to subscribe, because I don't write posts very frequently and not regularly, so that when they come out, it just gets emailed to you.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being on. That is it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. One ask, if you could head on over to iTunes. Actually, you can use the podcast app too, inside of your phone, if you're using the actual Apple podcast app, and just find my show and rate it 5 stars. That would be a huge help, because it gets the show recommended to more people, get more people listening. And that is the number one thing you can do to help me out. And hopefully the more people that listen, the better guests I have on the show.
Also, check out my newsletter. Head on over to kevinrose.com. There's a little newsletter tab there. You can tap on that, put in your email address, and I send a once a month newsletter that pretty much encapsulates all of my random articles and odd obsessions that I find every month. Cool videos, all kinds of craziness goes out in that newsletter. You'll want to subscribe to that. We're at 100,000 or so people are on that list with a little over 50% open rate, which is pretty awesome. So people are enjoying the content, and I want you to have that too. So head on over to kevinrose.com. And of course, that is the place where you can get all the show notes from this episode. We'll have it all linked up under Tim's podcast. All right, that's it for this episode. Be well.